Hello, Joe. What do you know? Welcome to the Bogart Film Affair.
That's right, baby.
What's all the fuss about?
Relax, Jack. Have another drink.
It smokes, it drinks, it philosophizes.
You mind telling me what it is I'm supposed to have done? At this rate, I'll be 60 before you get to the point.
After all these years of searching Hollywood cinema, I have finally found a film whose interest in blood and non sequiturs equals my own. Ladies and gentlemen, The Return of Dr. X. Before we go any further, I think it's important to put out a little disclaimer. Regardless of how much trash I'm about to talk or not talk about this film, and maybe you think I'm going to praise this film far too highly, regardless of what the next 20-some minutes brings, I truly loved this film. I enjoyed it so incredibly much. I can't tell you what a kick I got out of it. I think the first time I heard of The Return of Dr. X, I was reading the Sperber and Lax biography of Bogart, and in the middle of the book, in the pictures section, there's a pretty famous black and white photo I'd seen before of Bogart sitting in front of a mirror and applying makeup to himself. He might be shirtless. I'm not sure. I might have to double check. But his arm is kind of crossed in front of his body. He's applying makeup to his eye area, and he's got this skunk white streak just off center through the side of his hair. And I was intrigued. And then I later found out that he filmed a horror movie in which he plays... Well, I'm going to read you the synopsis I wrote for the Bogey Film Blog. When reporter Walter Garrett, played by Wayne Morris, stumbles across the body of a murdered actress and calls the police, he soon finds himself in hot water after the body disappears, and he's accused of making a false report. Later, when the dead actress shows up alive, Garrett loses his reporting job and teams up with a doctor, played by Dennis Morgan, to investigate a series of mysterious deaths that involve a mad scientist, played by John Lytle, and his undead assistant, Humphrey Bogart. I was so excited to see it. I finally found it on Netflix when we used to still do the Netflix DVD subscription. I found it on a collection of classic B horror movies. It's actually the sequel to another film starring Faye Ray called Dr. X, but you do not need to see the first one to understand this one. Frankly, you can watch this one and not understand this one on its own merits. But the first one had a somewhat similar plot. There's a crazy doctor doing experiments, I guess, and there's a wacky reporter trying to stop him. The two movies really don't cross over. So I found this film on Netflix on a collection. It showed up to my house. I had heard and read so much about this film that was negative, including Bogart himself being quoted multiple times as saying, "I hated this movie. It's trash. It's horrible. Don't watch it. I'm embarrassed." It's clearly a B-horror movie. I'd prepared myself to hate it. It's barely over an hour. I think it's like 62 minutes. It was a Friday night. I tell my wife, "Hey, I got this movie. It's supposed to be horrible. Humphrey Bogart plays an undead, possibly zombie scientist. I'm not sure what exactly is going on here. There's a wacky reporter." We sit down to watch it after the kids go to bed. I laughed out loud so many times. And not only ironically laughing, there are so many moments in this film that director Vincent Sherman really nails some pretty good humor. I think after all through the night, I was just kind of on a Vincent Sherman kick. The Return of Dr. X is actually the first film he directed with Bogart. This was not only Sherman's first film as a director with Bogart, this is Sherman's first film as a director. He'd had a couple writing credits before that with King of the Underworld and Crime School, films in which Bogart starred. But this is the first one where he was in the director's chair. This is the one that the studio, according to the Bogart bio by Eric Lax, this is the one that the studio had tasked him to do something different with Bogart, something that wasn't just the typical gangster role. And he certainly took Bogart and did something completely different here than the typical gangster role. I think, you know, I tend to break Humphrey Bogart's films down into multiple different categories. There are the gangster films. There are the ex-con or current con films. There are the war films. There are the expatriate loner films. This one falls into a much smaller category, one that I kind of refer to as the guilty pleasure category. You have this one, you have The Oklahoma Kid, you have the, you know, amazing pro wrestling film, Swing Your Lady. These are films that at the time did not get much attention. Not true. These are films that at the time got a lot of negative attention. But I think, you know, removed decades from their release, it's a lot more fun to sit back and watch some of these classic actors really ham it up and go crazy and have fun on film. Again, as he would later do in All Through the Night, Sherman takes this Hollywood genre of the horror film, spins it around, flips it over, relies much more on the humor than he does on the tension. I have a feeling a lot of this film was done firmly tongue-in-cheek, that Sherman knew what he was doing. He knew it wasn't the greatest script. He knew B-horror movies weren't the best assignment he could get as a director. It feels a lot like he's experimenting with some of the things he would use later when it comes to humor and parody in his films. Horror movies are pretty well known, I think, for using quite a bit of humor to alleviate the tension throughout a film. This one, if anything, uses the tension to alleviate the humor. But my wife and I finished watching this film, and she turns to me, and I wouldn't say she's a huge Humphrey Bogart fan by any means. I would say she puts up with my obsession. And she enjoyed it. She said she actually liked it quite a bit. And I did too. And I realized that for its time, this was a pretty bad movie. I mean, for our time, it's not that great. But for its time, I'm guessing there were a lot of teenage kids and young couples that went to the theater looking to be scared out of their minds and ended up finding, you know, Wayne Morris with the brim of his hat turned up, acting goofy and saying all sorts of crazy stuff, running around with a soap opera doctor. Bogart doesn't show, I mean, the movie's 62 minutes. Bogart doesn't show up until a good 20-some minutes in. And even then, his appearances are spotty. He's not in a ton of it, but when he's there, he is committed, 110%. This man committed to the role.
It's all your fault. I suppose you know that.
I've seen this one a few times now, so I'm just talking out loud. I'm trying to explain this plot to myself. So we have Wayne Morris as the wacky reporter, goes to interview an actress about her love life. She has a monkey. We're not told why she has a monkey. It's just something retired actresses do. She's a retired actress as well, by the way, who looks to be in her low 30s, so she must have done very well. Finds her dead. Now, here's the best part. Finds her dead, calls his newspaper to do a story, calls the police to report the murder. Here's the crazy thing about the police in this film. Cut to Wayne Morris sitting outside of the dead woman's apartment, reading front page news that he just wrote about her death. So the newspaper that he called to do the story on the murder prints an issue of the paper, gets it to him. He has time to go sit outside her apartment and begin to read. He's not even still on the first page. He's like three or four pages into the paper, and the police finally show up. So whatever, either this is an incredibly efficient newspaper, or these policemen need a little bit of help in doing their job. Maybe they're walking to crime scenes. They need to drive. I'm not sure. The overall plot, how do I do this? Okay, so there's, okay. So Wayne Morris is friends with a doctor at the hospital, played by Dennis Morgan. He consults with him about the woman who disappears, who then reappears and describes the wound, to which the doctor says, oh, that sounds like a wound that would kill you, but I need to check with the chief surgeon, Dr. Flegg. Goes to Dr. Flegg, who, I mean, there are some twists in this film, but we shouldn't be blindsided, okay? You're going to get a sense pretty quickly that something is up with Dr. Flegg. Not just because the man who plays him, John Lytle, is a pretty good actor and can subtly let us know that some things are up with his character. No, they have put him with the most amazing monocle I have ever seen that seems to somehow float magically just over his right eye. He doesn't squint. You know, this isn't a Colonel Klink situation where it looks like he's fighting to keep this thing on his face the entire time. It's just there. It must be pasted or glued somehow to his face. He has a goatee that is forked. He also has a part down the middle of his slicked back, greasy hair that's just a little off-center. The guy looks like trouble. We come to find out that he has been experimenting with raising the dead. And his first experiment was either a rabbit or Humphrey Bogart. I think it was Humphrey Bogart, who was... Now, here we go. Okay. Bogart plays the Dr. X in question. They call him Kane throughout the film, who was a scientist, doctor scientist that had been arrested for experimenting on babies and given the electric chair. Now, here were the experiments. He was pushing the edge of science by experimenting with the effects of starvation on babies. He was starving babies to see what it would do to them physically in a cabin in the woods. You know, the first time I watched this, I don't think I really stopped to question that. But, you know, even for 1930 science, I'm pretty sure most of the scientists could have surmised, if not outright known, what the effects of starving a baby would be. It's not like this guy was... I mean, somebody should have pulled him aside at some point during his first life and said, you know, they're not going to hand you a Nobel Prize. They're going to get skinny. They're going to die. People are going to be upset. So he's arrested. He's executed. Dr. Flagg brings him back from the dead because he's been experimenting with reanimating corpses through electrocution, which since Dr. Kane was electrocuted, he was already prepped. It doesn't really make a lot of sense when you watch it. So Dr. Kane, the assistant, comes back and begins to help Dr. Flagg, except he seems to have his own little side project of making artificial blood. He's obsessed with creating artificial blood to replace real blood with, because I think the artificial blood is needed to reanimate further corpses. But even after they're reanimated, they still look and apparently feel like corpses. They're white and clammy and cold and feel sick all the time. So I'm not sure what, why, it doesn't really matter, does it? No. There's plenty of other distractions in this film to keep you from thinking about the plot too often. Like, for instance, the love story where, you know, hospital surgeon Michael Rhodes, played by Dennis Morgan, is trying to start up a little romance with a nurse named Joan Vance, played by Rosemary Lane. She volunteers to donate blood during one of the surgeries he's sitting in on with Dr. Flagg, and he uses the opportunity to ask her out on a date. Now, here's the other really fun moment in the film where the date is interrupted when Wayne Moore shows up and wants Dr. Rhodes to investigate these recent bloodletting murders with him. Dr. Rhodes, not wanting to break his date, says to Nurse Vance, "Why don't you just come along? You can sit in the car. We'll get it done quickly, and then, you know, he'll drop us off at the nightclub where I've got reservations." Fantastic. So first, they put her in this convertible and take her to the actress who has died and come back to life to interview her, because she's apparently ready to talk and spill the whole truth. They get to her apartment, and they leave Rosemary Lane, Nurse Vance, in the car alone after it's been established that there is a man on the loose murdering people with her exact blood type. Not only that, but there's a good chance he has her name, address, and description. But we'll leave her in the car while we go into the apartment. They go into the apartment. They come back an indeterminate amount of time later. They're ready to go to the nightclub. No, Wayne Morris needs to get to the paper to talk to his boss about a new potential story. So they take off to the newspaper. Do they take... No, okay. Nothing dangerous about a newspaper office. Take her into... No, we'll leave her in the car again. Kill her on the loose, looking for her exact blood type. Go in and talk to the chief. Come back out. Well, now, no, they're not ready for the nightclub yet because they have to go to the undertaker because the actress they just interviewed has been murdered, called into the police, called into the newspaper, and already sent to the undertaker in about the 5 to 10 minutes that it took them to get to the newspaper office. So they take her to the undertaker again. Could you just please wait in the car. This will be over soon. Get done with all this between 1 and 2 a.m. Well, I'm just going to take you home. I know this hasn't been the ideal date. You know, we got to ride around town in a convertible with a reporter. That's not bad. It could have been worse. We'll make up for this date. What Nurse Vance continues to see in Dr. Rhodes after this night, I don't know. But maybe you know it's the whole rescue thing at the end that kind of smooths things over. They say when two people go through a really intense event together where there was a lot of adrenaline involved, sometimes their emotions can be overwhelmed in ways that they wouldn't be in a normal situation. I'm going to guess that's why these two have any shot at a romance whatsoever, because if you took your date, I don't have to explain it again.
It smokes, it drinks, it philosophizes.
Let's just take a couple minutes and talk about the cast from this one. I think, first of all, you have to mention Wayne Morris. Now, to describe Wayne Morris's character of Walter Garrett here, I think I would have to say to you, imagine that Philip Marlowe had a little brother who was a little goofy, maybe class clown, and just looked up to Philip, his older brother, as if the sun rose and set on his shoulders, and desperately wanted to be a detective, even though he knew nothing about what being a detective was, other than you ask questions. I really enjoyed Wayne Morris here. The first Bogart film I saw him in was Kid Galahad, and I was pretty rough on him. He's kind of big and dumb and lunky in that movie. And again, here, he's kind of big and dumb and lunky, but it was a role he played really well. The studio supposedly was trying to make another Errol Flynn out of Wayne Morris, and it never really took off. Ended up being a war hero and died at an early age from a heart attack. Kind of a sad story, but he left some pretty good roles on film. Here he plays the goofy reporter who is fearless, wears his heart on his sleeve, is quick with a joke, and maybe a little too much personal information at times. His pairing with Dennis Morgan as Dr. Michael Rhodes is quite a bit of fun. Dennis Morgan has had a handful of tiny roles, cameos in a few other Bogart films, not much at all. But to understand his character in this one, just imagine any super good-looking doctor from a daytime soap opera. Just a lot of head tilts and puzzled looks and longing eyes, just enough smooth charm to make the nurses fall in love with him, even though he doesn't seem all that intelligent. I think what I really liked about this film was that the pairing of Wayne Morris and Dennis Morgan really kind of foreshadows a similar relationship that we end up getting in The X-Files many years later, with a skeptical doctor teamed up with an investigator who's pretty sure something supernatural crazy is going on. John Lytle plays Dr. Francis Flegg, the main surgeon responsible for the reanimation of Humphrey Bogart in the film, the guy who's experimenting with artificial blood. Lytle's shared 7 or 8 other films with Bogart, a lot of smaller roles. This is probably one of his bigger roles. He does a great job. Again, I think he had enough acting talent here to pull off the role without the monocle, without the goatee, without the crazy hair. I think he could have probably played a slight, because he's not full mad. He doesn't play full mad like Bogart does. He only plays slightly mad. He plays just mad enough to reanimate a guy who starves babies and tries to create his own artificial blood and reanimates rabbits in the back room of his office. That's how, not super mad, just mad enough. Does a great job. Rosemary Lane, again, plays Nurse Vance, the woman that Dennis Morgan is trying to romance a little bit in the hospital. She's fine. The part is small. There's not much in the script to work with. If you want a better Bogart collaboration, go check out The Oklahoma Kid with James Cagney. She's got not a ton more to work with, but at least enough more to work with. She's not, you know, left in the background waiting for the guys to do everything in that film, at least. It's a little bit bigger, I guess. And then you've got, I'm not sure how to pronounce this, Lia Lice, as Angela Morova, the woman the retired actress who owns a monkey, who is murdered at the beginning of the film, reanimated, and then murdered again. You also have Charles Wilson as Detective Roy Kincaid, kind of the lead inept investigator. Here's the biggest question I left with from the film. So you've got these two detectives. that are chasing Wayne Morris and Dennis Morgan around the entire film. As the film goes on, they begin to get suspicious because Wayne Morris, his reporter, Walter Garrett, seems to be involved with either every murder or every fake murder, to the point where he wants to arrest him. Wayne Morris and Dennis Morgan somehow convince him what the true story is, that Dr. Kane has kidnapped Rosemary Lane, is taking her, kidnapped Nurse Vance, is taking her out to the woods. Okay, I can get that maybe they could be just convincing enough that they would take a drive with them to this cabin to check it out. But apparently after they get there, not only do they find Dr. Kane holding the woman hostage, but then they apparently deem it a good idea to give a gun to the reporter and possibly the doctor. I don't remember if he had a pistol or not, but Wayne Morris definitely has a pistol. Not only do they decide, you know, this is the reporter that we were kind of thinking might be involved a little bit, maybe. We're not sure. We're following his crazy leads the whole film. Let's give him a gun as we go confront the bad guy at the end. Jump out of the car, surround the house. Bogart pulls a gun, starts firing out the window. Now, out of all the law enforcement on hand, the guy who ends up running into the house is the goofy, bumbling reporter with a pistol. I'm just saying, when these reports are filled out at the end of the day, I think Detective Roy Kincaid is going to have a few questions he's going to need to answer for the sergeant, because this is just a little bit much. Also, keep your eyes peeled for Dead End Kid, Hunts Hall, who plays Pinky. He runs the file room with all the old clippings at the newspaper. Wayne Morris gets a few pretty good scenes with Hunts, and it was kind of fun to see a Dead End. It's always fun to see a Dead End Kid pop up without the rest of the Dead End Kids in tow, getting to play, you know, their own character, do their own thing, stand on their own 2 feet. Good to see a Hunt.
My conduct.
So on the Bogey Film Blog, I gave this one, I kind of said it was unrateable. I didn't give it the typical Bogey Fix rating. I gave it 3 out of 5, but there wasn't the typical Bogey publicity shot from the enforcer holding up his hand with the pistol. It was the Bogey is the mad scientist leaning in towards the camera, grimacing a little bit. 3 out of 5 for a good Bogey Fix here. I think what makes this film so incredibly unique is that Bogart does something here that I don't really remember any other classic Hollywood legend pulling off. I mean, Jimmy Stewart never played a wolfman. Cary Grant never played Dracula. Errol Flynn never played Frankenstein. But Bogart plays an undead mad scientist. There aren't many other legends of his stature that have a film like this in their past, that have a film of such schlock B-movie quality that you can enjoy in this day and age. Removed 70 years from this film, I'm sure at the time this film looked like a mess. I'm sure at the time everyone hated this thing. But looking back at it now, I mean, how great would it be if somebody unearthed, you know, a Gregory Peck film in which he plays Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster or, you know, a headless ghost roaming some old haunted mansion. We would love it. We would go crazy. No matter how bad that film would be, everyone would want to see it. Well, here we have the chance. We have Bogart playing an undead mad scientist. And if you tell Bogart to play an undead mad scientist, he's going to play the best undead mad scientist you can get. I mean, when he walks in stroking that white rabbit, wearing the lab coat, face pale, skunk-streaked hair, you have to imagine that Ernst Blofeld, James Bond's nemesis, borrowed just a little bit from that moment, because Bogart made a very memorable villain here. Not only that, but on the blog, on the Bogey Film Blog, I always do the classic Bogey moment from every film where he does a mannerism or has a phrase or a line that's just utterly Bogart in a way that only Bogart could do it. Here at the end of the film, I defy you to watch the climax of this film as he's shooting his way out of the cabin and not pause it for just a second when he begins to fire his pistol and think to yourself, Duke Mantee. He's even got the hands sort of at his waist. He's shooting not necessarily from the hip, but he kind of moves the hand in front of his stomach a little bit in what has to be the most inefficient way to actually shoot your way out of a building, almost as if, yeah, I'm just doing this for effect. I know I'm not going to make it out of this. It's a very Duke Mantee-ish moment, a great little physical sight callback to the Petrified Forest. Whether he intended it to be so or not, I don't know. But it was a great few seconds in the film before he gets his just desserts.
Shut up, sugar.
Okay, so since The Return of Dr. X would be considered one of my major guilty pleasures, a film that I'll pop in, even though it's, you know, not the greatest quality, I kind of threw out to a lot of the Twitter folk that I was looking for people's guilty pleasures. What are the films that they pop in over and over, even though, you know, they might not be the most classic films around? You know, personally for me, probably the one I've seen the most, and I'm a little embarrassed to admit this, for some reason, Robert Downey Jr.'s Iron Man. I've probably seen Iron Man, not joking, 60, 70 times. It's the one film I have on my iPod, on my computer. I travel a lot. I'll even pop it in. This is ridiculous. I'll pop it in on the iPod and just listen to the audio as I'm driving without even being able to watch the picture. I don't know why it speaks to me. It just, for some reason, it's just as good as cheap popcorn entertainment can get. It's just as good as Hollywood blockbuster popcorn entertainment can get. So I threw out to everybody on the Twitter sphere, the tweet sphere, the Twitter. I'm an old man. I threw out to everybody on Twitter, what's your favorite guilty pleasure film? At Olivia Scouten, OliviaSchouten, a friend of mine. She's also works in biology. Right now she's studying prairie grasslands somewhere in Iowa. She said I could watch The Princess Bride any day. I would agree. That's one I go to over and over again. JP, young lady who's a writer on, I think is she in Tennessee? I'm not sure. At Hollywood Comet. She runs the blog Hollywood Comet. Google it. It's a fantastic blog. She covers a lot of classic era Hollywood musicals. At Hollywood Comet, spelled just like Hollywood and Comet, says maybe one of my favorite answers, Hot Rods to Hell and Trashy 1950s Films. I'm going to admit, JP, I have never seen Hot Rods to Hell, but I am now intrigued. Ken Lally, I think it's pronounced Lally, at Ken Lally, Lally. I started following Ken, I don't remember who followed who first. He's an actor in Hollywood. He's a stuntman. He's had a lot of really fun, interesting projects. I think he might have played a pirate in one of the Pirates of the Caribbean. He's got a good short film for a video game online. He does stunt work for video games as well. A fun guy to follow. Right now he's actually working on a film noir television series where he plays a detective. Or maybe a nightclub singer, I don't remember. Maybe he's a nightclub singing detective. He's tweeted a few pics about it. It's called Baker and Dunn, and it seems to be very much in the vein of a lot of Bogart's film noir. I guess there aren't any details about when this is going to come out, you know, online, on television. He's been a little cagey about it, but it sounds like it's going to be fun. Okay, he answered guilty film pleasure, Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man. I've seen it. I'm not going to say I hated it, but if I die without seeing it again, I'm not going to complain. But I, you know, as far as guilty pleasures go, that's fantastic. I can't imagine a guiltier pleasure than Harley Davidson, the Marlboro Man. At Timeless Movie Magic, which is spelled at Timeless Movie M, the letter M, he collects and sells film posters in the UK. I actually interviewed him once on the blog. Really interesting guy. You should definitely go check out his website, timelessmoviemagic.co.uk. You know, I don't know how the currency exchange works, but he's got some really sweet film posters. He tweeted back, gotta love a bit of Predator. And then I'm not going to do an Arnold Schwarzenegger. You know what? I'm going to do an Arnold Schwarzenegger impression. He wrote, gotta love a bit of Predator. Get to the chopper. You know what? I love that one too. I would say that if that's on TV and I'm zipping through, I will watch the first Predator. Biff Tannen, at Bert Ward for hire. Bert, as in the name, WARD for hire. He's a huge film noir guy. Works with the Evil Geeks website. Check out the Evil Geeks. Just Google Evil Geeks. They have their own podcast too. We kind of got hooked up on Twitter through, I think, our love of film noir and comic books. He answered, Flash Gordon 30 serials. Perfect. Yes, I remember watching those at my grandmother's house on Saturday afternoons and being like, what in the world are we sitting through right now? And Transformers animated 80s movie, again, you should feel guilty. That is horribly fantastic. And then 16 Candles, a classic, but, you know, I don't know, maybe because he's a guy, you know, he feels a little guilty. I'm not sure. Chris Gumprich, at Gumprich, G-U-M-P-R-I-C-H, a guy out of Canada that I got to know a little bit on Twitter because he's a huge diehard Bogart fan. He's a completist, someone who once wanted to see every single Bogart film, and I think he's seen everything that's ever been released or available. Answered Invasion USA, the 1952 Gerald Moore classic. Again, fantastic, guilty pleasure, one of those so bad it's good films. Also, every movie by Ed Wood, especially Glenn or Glinda. And here's one of the glaring holes in my cinema fandom, is I've never seen Glenn or Glinda, and I've never seen anything Ed Wood's done except for Plan 9 from Outer Space, which I know makes me sound like an idiot, and that's because I'm an idiot. Another old friend of mine, Biscuit of York, Becky, at Biscuit of York, Y-O-R-K, answered Breakfast at Tiffany's. Funny answer, considering that way back in high school, she's the one who introduced me to Breakfast at Tiffany's. here's a good one. Darby O'Gill and the Little People, which I don't think I've seen since I was about 10. I can totally see, you know, falling into that one over and over again. And The Little Princess, which I've got to admit I've never seen. Mean Streets Podcast, which is at Mean, MeanStsOtrPod, answered 60s Filmation Batman and Disney's Condor Man. Love anything Batman, even the goofy stuff. I actually enjoyed Condor Man too. But more importantly, I want to mention Mean Streets because he runs a fantastic podcast and Tumblr page where he talks about and then airs vintage classic radio, several of which so far have dealt with Humphrey Bogart. He's had some Bold Adventure stuff. I think he did the Maltese Falcon. He's interviewed me a few times for the podcast or, you know, for his online, I think it's a Tumblr page, and given the Bogart film blog a shout out a few times on the podcast. You should go check it out. Just go to iTunes and type in Mean Streets Podcast or Down These Mean Streets and it'll come up. And that's it. Those are the responses I got. Guilty pleasures. Everybody's got to have a few. There are some people out there in the world who, if you ask them their favorite films, the first 10 they would mention would seem like they should be guilty pleasures and not honest to goodness love. But I try not to fault people for the films that they love. I try to, you know, let everybody love what they love. And, you know, but yeah, Return of Dr. X. That's one that I pop in occasionally just for laughs. It's a good time. Check it out. Find me at Bogey Film Blog on Twitter. I am bogeyfilmblog@gmail.com. So you can find me either one of those places or, as I said earlier in the podcast, bogeyfilmblog.wordpress.com or the Bogart Film Affair on iTunes. Have a great week.
Oh, this is the end.